going to spend a little time this morning talking about the law of unforeseen consequences, which certainly picks up or certainly comes into effect anytime I pick up a guitar. It's always an adventure into the unpredictable. Back in the 1990s, the German rock band, the Scorpions, were internationally famous, of course, and Wind of Change was one of their biggest hits. It's a joyous rock anthem to honor Germany's reunification. Most of the world was celebrating the Soviet Union's collapse and the collapse of communism across Eastern Europe at that time. But of course, one thing we've learned since then is that no victory or defeat is ever as complete as it seems in the moment. Progress brings change, and change is an uncertain business. And that goes for churches just as much as in world affairs. And that's exactly what Unitarian Universalist theologian Sharon D. Welch talks about in her book, A Feminist Ethic of Risk. She writes, quote, "What we know, while vast, rests on shaky foundations. As we attempt to ascertain the effects of our actions, we are challenged to keep in mind the law of unintended consequences. Our actions, no matter how carefully thought out, have unpredictable effects, multiple consequences for good or ill, and often for both." Close quote. The law of unintended consequences. Progress only comes with change, but change is an uncertain business. Actions have unanticipated reactions. And looking back, my own personal story is kind of a study in this very fact. I loved being read to as a kid. By the age of 8, I was reading far above grade level. Somewhere along the line, I decided I was going to become a world-famous writer myself. And all through school, I considered myself a great writer in training. I would watch the way people behaved and try to understand why. I wrote stories through elementary school and high school, majored in English in college. Of course, after college, I got married and did my required military service and fathered children. But all that while, from grade school through my 20s, I would return to tablets and notebooks and then evenings at the typewriter. I'd get frustrated and give up for a while, did that more than once, but I'd always lick my wounds and then start over again. And in my 30s and 40s, I did get several novels published nationally, just for the record. But being a published novelist was not what I expected. Sales were not as good as I'd hoped. Years passed, and I was not writing the books I'd set out wanting to write. I wanted something more, something meatier that would make a meaningful difference in people's lives. And what I didn't know, all those years reading, honing my writing skills, my fascination with human nature and the human condition, none of that ever made me a very successful novelist, and it certainly didn't make me a great one, but it was perfect training to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. That was the biggest surprise of my whole life. Change and the law of unintended consequence. If you had told me, even at age 40, that I would turn out to be a minister in Indiana, I'd have told you, you were crazy. Giving up my career as a novelist, for the record, was the most painful thing I ever had to do, even harder than my divorce, but it's also the smartest thing I ever did. I hadn't even finished divinity school when I was wishing I'd started 20 years earlier. We cannot grow and develop and achieve our potential until we accept the reality of change and unpredictable results. We nurture our best selves by nurturing change, all in light of the fact that we never know exactly what that change will bring us. Change and the law of unintended consequences. Now, for the record, I am proudly an atheist, but being atheist does not mean I lack faith. To face life's challenges and unintended consequences, and more than that, to face them with a stout heart and enjoyment of life, is in itself a faith practice. Faith that I can surf those unpredictable waters and that something worthy will come of my efforts. And believe me, in today's world, that is a stubborn kind of faith. I'm just saying. One of my favorite examples of the richness of change and unintended consequences is the 18th century Unitarian English minister, Joseph Priestley. Of course, chemistry teachers know that in his spare time, Priestley was a scientist, and he was a good one. He discovered seltzer water, he was the first person to describe photosynthesis, and he was also the first person to isolate the gas oxygen. In 1766, he built what he called an electricity machine, and today we'd call it a static generator. Playing around with sparks from his electricity machine, Priestley found out spectacularly that if he set off a spark in a vial of swamp gas, which we now know is mostly methane, he'd get an explosion. Now, later he became a vocal supporter of the American and French revolutions, and that so angered his neighbors in Birmingham, England, that they burned his house and laboratory to the ground, and he fled to the United States, where he founded the Unitarian Church of Philadelphia and faded from the scientific picture. But other scientists kept working on his explosive swamp gas discovery, and they were hoping to turn it into a weapon, a swamp gas pistol fired with electricity. Meanwhile, an Italian named Giovanni Venturi decided he didn't like the smell of the sickness and rot at the hospital where he worked, so he invented a device he called an atomizer to spray perfume and mask the odors. The key part of his spray bottle, where the liquid perfume mixed with oil or mixed with air to form a mist, is still named for him. It's called a Venturi. Later yet, in the 1850s, some people in Titusville, Pennsylvania, were figuring out what to do with the crude oil that seeped out of the ground near a place fittingly called Oil Creek. A man named Edwin Drake figured out how to drill for the oil and obtain it in bulk, and another man, Samuel Martin Kerr, figured out how to refine it into lamp oil, which they named after him, kerosene. His refining process also produced a dangerously explosive byproduct, which they threw away, and that later became known as gasoline. You can probably see where all this is going. In the late 1800s, a German inventor named Nicholas Otto realized he could pump tiny amounts of this gasoline through Venturi's atomizer, blow it up with a spark from Priestley's generator, and the explosion would push down an even older invention, originally developed in the 1690s to pump wastewater out of mine shafts, namely a piston. The piston would turn a crankshaft, and voila, you had the automobile engine. And that's the law of unintended consequences in action. Every component of the basic car engine was originally invented by somebody trying to invent something else. Venturi's atomizer became the carburetor. A four-barrel carburetor has four Venturis. Priestley's swamp gas pistol became the spark plug, and so on. Things will develop in ways no one could predict. And as we dance with life, in Sharon D. Welch's words, our actions, no matter how carefully thought out, and perhaps precisely because they're carefully thought out, have multiple consequences, for good or ill, often for both. Now, I suggest that one thing we can take from all this is that we have a choice in our attitude toward change. We can let the law of unintended consequences paralyze us and try to avoid any change whatsoever, which will not work and will almost certainly result in changes we don't want. Or we can thoughtfully, courageously, even joyfully journey into change with curiosity, faith, and resolve to help make the world a better place. And for the record, that's a key piece of what Sharon D. Welch's Feminine Ethic of Risk is all about. It accepts that we cannot keep the world from changing. We cannot make our advantages and comforts permanent. And she invites us to accept the risks of change while nurturing the rewards of change in the knowledge that it might not turn out the way we expect. And that takes courage. Back in the 1920s, when my father was a farm boy in eastern Iowa, my grandfather bought the family's first car. It was a used Model T Ford, and his grandmother, they called her Grandma Eby, lived with them, and she asked him how fast that car would go, to which he responded, "Oh, it'll get up to 15 or 20 miles an hour." And her mouth fell open, and she said, "Land sakes, people weren't made to go that fast." And she wouldn't ride in it. Decades passed before anyone could talk her into getting into a car. She missed out on some nice trips. For the record, her daughter, who was my grandmother, didn't have any problem riding in a car, but no way was she ever going to get into an airplane. And she never did. So I'm telling these stories because I have to admit that I don't come out of a line of real visionary people. All I can do is look at the lessons of the past and try to project them onto my own behavior in the future. But having spent most of my ministry in Columbus, Indiana, and staying with the automotive theme I've got started here, of course, down in Columbus, you have Cummins Diesel. And that story begins right after the First World War. If you don't already know it, the Miller family of Columbus owned the Irwin Union Trust Bank, and they were one of the richest families in the country. Their chauffeur was a fellow named Clessy Cummins, and he liked to tinker around with car and truck engines in his spare time. So the family set him up in business in 1919, heavily funding an outfit they called Cummins Diesel. And actually, to tell the story, I need to take the diesel part back to the 1800s, German inventor Rudolf Diesel. Rudolf Diesel, this was before the gas engine even, envisioned an engine which could run on cheap fuel and produce power more efficiently than the steam engines of his day. And he got research funding from the famous Krupp Steel Works, but what they wanted was an engine that would run on coal dust. Coal dust experiments didn't work out real well. Engines fueled on coal dust kept exploding. But by 1898, Diesel had come up with a working engine, which he exhibited at the World's Fair that year in Paris. The engine ran quite nicely on, of all things, peanut oil. Diesel engines ran on vegetable oils clear into the 1920s. But the catch was, those engines were really large and they were really heavy, as much as 400 pounds per horsepower, which meant that they could only be used for stationary industrial power. Later they used them on ships and railroad engines. Back in the United States, after the First World War, the Miller family bought rights to Diesel's patents, and Clessy Cummins started designing a diesel engine small enough to fit into a car or truck. By 1929, he had one small enough to install in a Packard limousine. Then he put an improved model into a Duesenberg and took it down for time trials in Daytona. And according, I got this off the Cummins website, a Cummins-powered race car even ran in the 1930 Indianapolis 500. It didn't go real fast, but to this day, it's the only car to complete the 500 without having to make a pit stop. What that would demand of the driver, I can't imagine, but we won't go there. The year after that, Cummins himself was on the team driving a specially built Cummins diesel truck coast to coast on $11.22 worth of fuel. They had a scary moment when the brakes failed in California going down the west side of Cajon Pass. They almost crashed into a freight train, but Cummins and the truck survived and made newspaper headlines across the country. Despite the publicity he was getting, and the reason I bring this whole story up, the Cummins company failed to turn a profit for the first 18 years of its existence. They stayed in the red, draining funds from the Miller family's Irwin Union Trust Bank until the late 1930s. So who would have thought, back in 1930, or even making a small profit in 1939, that the Irwin Union Trust would now be bankrupt, taken over by another bank, doesn't exist anymore, while their former money-losing subsidiary, Cummins Diesel, is now one of the largest, most successful, and most conscientious companies in the world. Who would have thought? Great things require vision and the courage to invite change even when you don't know precisely where that change is going to take you. Because we never do know precisely where change will take us. That goes for church communities just as much as anyone else. But make no mistake, the human condition itself is a spontaneous relationship with the universe. We can try to learn the rules. That's what science and the study of ethics is all about. But in the end, we cannot control that relationship or even fully understand it. Vital and wonderful though each human life is, we are also infinitesimal before the vastness and complexity that surround us. And life before the vastness of the universe is not a simple walk. It has to be a dance. We give our best to the universe. We receive from the universe, and really, we won't find out until later whether the universe's gift to us was wonderful or not so good. Probably, we will find out it really is a combination of the two. In a very real sense, liberal religion embodies that unpredictable dance with the universe. And I think it's safe to say liberal religion is devoted to progress, to helping make the world a better place. We look at an unpredictable future in faith that the future can and should ultimately come to be better than the past. But that doesn't happen without courage and commitment and persistence and the willingness to dance with change. We Unitarian Universalists do refer to ourselves as a church without a creed, but if you look at it a little bit differently, expand that word, you could say we do share a kind of religious creed. It's just not a creed of words. It's not a creed of common belief. It's a creed of practice. It's a way of practice. We promise to be with one another in the world in a loving and principled way. We promise to share and listen to one another and care for one another in agreement, but also in disagreement, to support one another through joy and laughter, but also through tears and disappointment, and most of all, to be present to that evolving universe and to evolve with it. Of course, religious words, even liberal ones, are easy. Religious living is what's difficult. Life rarely does provide smooth sailing. It often does take us directions we didn't plan to go. Our actions, no matter how carefully thought out, have unpredictable effects, multiple consequences. That is not a call to cling to our present situation or try to avoid the challenges that come with change. Rather, it's a call to embrace change in the knowledge that only by joyfully courting changes and challenges can we really hope to achieve the highest liberal religious vision. Amen. May it be so.